analogy here. I don't. I want to thank. Firstly, I want to welcome you on behalf of Mizrahi, who is really our partner in this evening's in this evening's program. Mizrahi, which I am proud to be a member and supporter of, who does a lot of work for Torah education both here and throughout the world. So I want to thank them, and Jack Kahn is here, I saw, and I believe I saw Jerry Rosenfeld here before. I want to thank them for their help in the sponsorship of the program. I also want to thank Dr. Warren Goldstein, who we really is, the medical ethics program we had in the morning was a partnership. And I want to thank him and his crew for all their help. And those of you who were here know how wonderful a program it was. Already they're asking me. Okay, green Chrysler Voyager minivan. I know whose car it is already. 429 VAY. Lights are on. We won't in. Leave in a few minutes. I know who it is. I recognize the license plate at the... It's not us. I just want to make a couple other and another brief announcement. Our next program of this nature, Emir Tzashem, will be at the weekend, April 1-2, where again over Shabbos we'll be bringing in Chana Henkin, Rabbanit Chana Henkin, and her husband, Rav Yehuda Herzl Henkin, and Rabbi Dov Linzer and Dvorah Slatshauer for the weekend. We'll be having a Shabbos program and a Sunday program. The details are not all worked out yet. But those keep that in mind. We'll be having like a Yom Iyun, a learning session in the morning, and then in the evening we'll also be having a panel. So if you can mark it off in the calendars, and you'll be hearing more information about it. Also, there are not too many books left. Actually, most of them were sold in the morning. Dr. Lam, his book, The Power of Hope, is available for those who'd like to buy it. I believe it retails for about $25, and it will be on sale here for $15. Okay, let's get started with the program. The topic, Orthodoxy, examines itself really, I think, as a sign of strength in our community, that we have matured to the point where we can critically analyze ourselves, our challenges, our future, our mistakes, our strengths. And you know, a couple generations ago, all the sociologists said there wouldn't be orthodoxy within a generation or two, and it's a sign of vitality that we can come and head on examine. We don't have to be so apologetic and defensive. And hopefully the evening is going to be on a very high level and very serious. There are serious issues in our community that have to be addressed. And we do not think we're not going to solve all the problems or any of the problems, but really if we think about it, and the more people who are concerned about it, the more that can and will be done in the future. So I just hope this is a start toward, just like in the Yamim Narayim and Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, we do a personal Cheshbon HaNefesh, a personal self-examination. This is more of a communal self-examination, and we really have two excellent speakers, wonderful, you know, people who I think can add a lot and shed a light on the issue. Now, we're going to have both speakers. We'll talk back-to-back. We'll give you like a two-minute break in between, and then we'll have questions afterwards. We will not take questions till the end of the program. Then we'll, you know, as long as you would like and our speakers would like. Yes, and tapes are available for sale for the program. Plus, the program we had in November, for those who were and weren't here, we do have the tapes here available. The program we had with Rivka Blau and Mayor Schiller and Barry Freundel. So we have the tapes. Will be available for sale afterwards. Okay, I'd like to introduce now our first speaker, Rabbi Lam, Rabbi Maurice Lam, who I've already introduced once. Who spent many, many years as a rabbi of the Beit Jacob Synagogue in Beverly Hills, California, the author of a number of books. The most famous we all know is The Jewish Way in Death and Mourning, which I mentioned in the morning has sold more copies than any other English Jewish book in history. So I think that's a tribute to him. And as he mentioned, an update, a 30-year update is coming up with some of the newer issues, organ transplantation for one, that will be addressed in the book coming out in the summer. The Power of Hope that we have here, He is the president of the National Jewish Hospice Institute for Jewish Hospice. He runs that, is based in California. He is the father of 3 children and 18 grandchildren. And without further ado, the Rabbi Maurice Lam.
I think you're applauding my 18 grandchildren. Thank you, Rabbi Kelman. My grandfather used to start his drasha by saying, before I speak, I want to say a few words. That always happens. This one, too. I do want to thank Rabbi Kelman and Ilana for being superb hosts. And yes, applaud them. And I want to thank Dr. Elliot Malamud, who is a superb organizer and whose calls are wonderful. And while you're applauding, there's a great rabbi sitting here, Reuven Bulka. Give it to him, too. Having said that, I'm done. Did you all see the flyer that went out with the questions that the committee has designed, the questions that were put to the speakers? Their questions, I can see, are the result of long thinking and much editing by the committee. They're sharp, they're penetrating, they're good, and if you read them, you feel that they're spoken out of agony, out of pain, out of worry about what really is happening to this community, not to this community, but to the national and world Orthodox Jewish community. The question is, where are we at? And then we can address what are we doing right or wrong. Salo Baron, who is a professor at Columbia University, professor of history, one of the greatest professors of history in all of America, Salo Baron once said that Jews have a lachrymose history. He says, Goyim have history. Jews have tzaris. Tzaris? You understand that much Yiddish, right? Hebrew? Tzaris is tzaris. And if you don't know what it means, you are of tzaris. We Jews live in history and look at history in strange ways. Salo Baron's counterpart at Hebrew University was Jacob Katz. And Jacob Katz said that Jewish history is manic depressive. It swings to 2 extremes. Usually it's this way. Today is Hazman Hazer. Tomorrow is Yemos HaMashiach, the times of the Messiah. Hasman Hazeh is always bad news. Bad news. Where we're living today, the way we're living today, bad news. It's galut, diaspora, terror. Whatever happens, happens for the worst. And we are not in our land. Our people are doomed to suffer. Look, there's tzaris there and there and there and there and there. And as a matter of fact, historically, we have yarbuchs. You know, the books of the, not Yarbus, but the Sefer HaZichronos, books of communities that list the dead, and we've had numerous dead, almost more than we had population, people born, until historians found out that these were duplicated in every town. And there were so many, multiple duplications, but we always looked at Zman HaZeh these days as really days of horror. The future is Yemos HaMashiach. Listen, if you're living badly now, in the future, God will take care of it. Mashiach will come. And that is the way we have done our history in manic depressive state. Today is Oy Vey, and tomorrow is Baruch Hashem. The problem with that formulation is that it's outdated. And now we're living the reverse. Namely, in our day, Baruch Hashem. But the future may be Oy Vey. It's just the reverse. Today, we have more yeshivot than we ever had in the history of the Jewish people. There's more Torah learning on more continents today, and surely more in Israel, and surely in America, than ever before. North American prosperity, enables us to live at ease as Jews, unequaled, internationally. Who can believe that 50 years after the Holocaust, nations would be falling over each other, tripping over each other, apologizing for the bloodshed as though that made it better, but apologizing is better than not apologizing. But the future does seem like it's Oy Vey, in the words of Rabbi Bulka, in the title of one of his books, it's a coming cataclysm. Or is it? I think I reached the bottom of sadness about this problem when I traveled to Australia in the mid-80s, and I landed in Sydney in November. And I remember being greeted by the committee that asked me to speak and deliver a series of lectures. And they said to me, as soon as I got off the plane, "Rabbi, scrap your first talk." Every speaker loves to hear that. "You have to give another talk because Alex Schindler, who was the president of the Union of American Hebrew Congregations, the Reform lay body, had been there for the Yomim Noraim, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and there were headlines for 3 weeks after he was there saying about the Orthodox, you need to have no worry and forget about it because they're going to be a thing of the past. It's gone. The community in North America is over." So, as the first speaker, and the first time that you speak, you get the largest crowd, I didn't have any statistics at hand. I called back to Los Angeles. I couldn't get an American Jewish yearbook in Australia. I couldn't even get one in Los Angeles. It was night there, day there. I was going crazy. I decided no statistics for me, no figures. And I stood up there and I said, "I hear what Rabbi Schindler has said. I only want to tell you a story. The story is of my mechutin, my former mechutin, but my mechutin, Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg." Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg, who used to be in Toronto, Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg said when he came back from Israel one time that his older brother, Rabbi Moshe Weinberg, was no longer going out of the house. So being used to hospice situations, I commiserated with him and I said, I'm really very sorry to hear that." He said, "Why are you sorry?" "I'm sorry because he doesn't go out of the house anymore. He's locked into a home. And what kind of life is that?" He said, "No, you don't understand." Moshe Weinberg had 13 children. Each one of his children in Yerushalayim had a minimum of 13 children. So he quickly, if you do the multiplication of only 13 times 13, he had 1,690 great-grandchildren. 1,690, if we just take an arbitrary number of 10 in the third generation, not 13, and don't count the peak, count the moderate number, he had 1,690 great-grandchildren. And 169 grandchildren and 13 children. So he complained to his brother, Reb Yaakov, and he said, "You know, Asholem Zocha, Abris, Apidjin Aben. a bar mitzvah, a bas mitzvah, a vort, tznoim, chuppe, sheva brachos. Ich wär mishuge. So what did he do? So he built himself on a room to his house, and that was the catering hall. And now all of the smachot come there. He no longer goes out of his house. He's stuck there celebrating every day of the week. So when Alex Schindler tells me that about some reformed Jew, I'm willing to argue with him. Until then, we hold the day. I said it, but I felt vacant inside because I'm not sure that that was not that situation, but not generally true. I didn't know what to do, what tack to take. The Chinese have a proverb: if you don't change directions, we'll end up where we're headed. I came back, and I did some work in this, and I read Rabbi Bolker's book, and it was cataclysmic, and I want to explain this to you. The explanation I give you, because I lived in California, we are living as a Jewish community on a surface under which are two tectonic plates clashing with one another and making the ground unstable and making us very nervous. One of those tectonic plates that's causing earthquakes in the Jewish community is skyrocketing intermarriage. The second is a sinking birth rate. The first ominous sign that we had of the coming cataclysm is a document by Dr. Bergman, who is the chief of the Demographic Institute at Harvard, who said in 1976 that if in the year 2076 intermarriage would go above the rate of 50%, then the Jewish community in America may end up to have only 10,000 people left. I told the Jews in Australia that they will all be named Weinberg. Listen. Listen to our Tzoros, to the Oyvei. The secular rate of intermarriage, 72%. The Reform, 53%. The Conservative, 37%. The Orthodox, 3%. The second ominous sign, the sinking birth rate. We have radical new statistics which cannot be taken whole, as many people have been taking these particular statistics done by a friend of mine in Los Angeles, one of the people, Dick Horowitz. If you have 200 people in the first generation, Reform, Conservative, Orthodox, and you break the Orthodox into Yeshiva and Torah Umada, centrist Orthodox, and secularists, then you have a birth rate for the secularists of 1.62, and for Reform, 1.72, and for Conservative, 1.84, and for centrist Orthodox, 3.2, and for Yeshiva Orthodox, 6.4. which are incredible statistics, if they're true. Which would leave you in the fourth generation, without giving you all the details of the statistic, with 10 of the 200 that we started with, of 10 Jews left for the secularists, of 27 of the 200 left for Reform, of 48 from the 200 conservative, and for the Torah Umada crowd, 692. And for the yeshiva crowd, 5,176. I really don't stand by these numbers. I do not attest to their accuracy. One of them was a Fulbright scholar who worked on this. However, let's not take the top level. Let's just take a median level. Let's say it's moderately so. Then you have so many more being born to Orthodox than you have to conservative. Of course, they didn't consider the fact that of the Jewish community today, only 7% at best is Orthodox. That's the same with Rachmanis. Only 7%. Like 44% are conservative and reform, and the other part is secularist. So even if you have all of these imbalance, all of this imbalance in the statistics, you're starting off with a different series of statistics for the Orthodox than you are for conservative and reform. It's not equal. What happened then, because the Orthodox have such a high birth rate and such a low intermarriage rate, those figures are fairly secure, the intermarriage rates, then what happened is that we have much to cheer about as Orthodox Jews. Much to cheer about. Because not only is the birth rate among the highest, but the intermarriage among the lowest, and even those who are married, 9 in 10 are married to Jews, 1 in 10 is not, and half of the people, half of the spouses whom they marry have converted to Judaism. And there's a lower divorce rate. I'm not terribly sure if this doesn't go, you know, match the conservative and reform and secularist every year more and more. The majority of the 14% of the American Jews who seriously consider living in Israel were Orthodox, the overwhelming majority. Fully 57% of the Orthodox Jews give to Jewish causes, more than any other group. And you know the big surprise, a greater percentage of Orthodox Jews give more money to secular causes than Reform and Conservative. More of the Jews give to secular causes and to medical causes, but the big bucks coming from the people who have the fewest bucks, the Orthodox community, because they're so designed to give tzedakah. They score higher in their attachments than any other denomination. They have ethnic pride more than any other. They change communities when they move. They don't let communities change them. We are wealthier than we were before. We're far better educated. We enter the professions without sacrificing our frumkeit. Interestingly, that of the Jews who came to America after 1950, before 1950, 52% of Orthodox Jews went to at least 1 year to 3 years of college. And after 1950, figures were a whopping 81%. So if you hear that from Jews don't go to college and never went to college, 81% of religious Jews went to university, and most of them graduated from university and are in professions. And it's because of the Orthodox Union that kosher food is so available all over the world. It's a $100 million business in Hashkochas alone. You're talking big, big bucks with major companies. And we have unprecedented political power. So now that I have read for you a litany of what is so good about what we are doing today, Yemos HaMashiach. So if it's so good, why is it so bad? And it is. I don't want to leave you the impression that all is hunky-dory in the Orthodox state, because we're suffering from two things in Orthodoxy, among other things. We produce more books than ever before. We learn more. We have a Chevra Shas. We have Daf Yomi. Thousands of people. Everything is wonderful. They're great organizations. Wonderful. Yeshiva University has over 2,100 undergraduates. Not graduates, undergraduates. That's utterly incredible to think that that happened in this country. Wonderful. So what is then wrong? I'll tell you what is wrong. What happens to us is what happens to people who win. We not only triumphed, we practiced triumphalism. We not only won the game, we get all the sicknesses that are magnetized to people when they win. And we get the people's minds, the people who win, who conquer, what becomes to the conquerors, how they handle themselves. Rarely do we find somebody who wins or a group that wins to handle themselves with grace and to be benevolent. In a sense, like America is benevolent in the world. And so what happened is that, in my view, we Orthodox Jews could, if we continue, bring ruin on our own heads in America and in Israel. I kid you not. Not only do I not kid you, I say it with the utmost fear and trembling. It's a looming disaster, not the numbers, but the numbers we win. We won't be 7% in the middle of the 21st century. We may be 20% of the share of Jews living here. But first we have to give an accounting. Now that we are succeeding as we are succeeding, first we must give an accounting as to what we are doing with our brothers, with the Jews who are not succeeding, who are marrying out, who are not reproducing, who are assimilating at unbelievable rates, who are thinking of Israel in the ugliest terms. What are we doing with these people? You know what we're doing with them? Nothing? No. Worse. We're reading them out of the community. When first I talked to some people, I couldn't believe what I was hearing. My brother tells me that he spoke to one great Hasidic rabbinic luminary, who of course will be nameless. So he said to my brother, Rav Lam, I'll say it in English. He says, well, you know, we have fewer than 1 million Jews in America. So my brother said, we have 5.5 million Jews in America. He said, no, 1 million. And it was a headline in a Yiddish paper, 1 million Jews in America. What do you mean, 1 million Jews in America? But we know it's not true. Why say that? So he told my brother, he's not counting women who don't cover their head. Well, it's a problem for my brother, because his wife and my wife and Rabbi Soloveitchik's wife don't cover their heads. But how can you say that you don't count as Jews people who don't cover their heads? And to get 1 million, you didn't count a whole lot more people. What happened to the 4.5 million people? They're not Jews. All right. Could be one man. Kooky. So the whole world doesn't have to be condemned because of one man. Then I spoke to a very, very well-known intellectual, Rosh Yeshiva. And his answer? His answer was, listen, Ramayisha, don't worry about it. It's too bad. That's the way history treats people. They're going to fall off. They're gone. They're gone. I can't even think that they're gone. We can't write off 4.5 million people. We can't write off 3 million people. Who are we to do that? How triumphalist can we be? Who dares say they don't exist? We have a most painful dilemma. The question is to include or to exclude the masses of non-observant Jews. I feel, and you feel, a profound love for all Jews, and I believe that love itself is a mitzvah d'oraisa. It's a biblical mitzvah, min haTorah. And I refuse to look upon the possibility of losing a major part of our people. And I think keeping them is a halachic imperative of the highest order, higher than a whole lot of other detailed imperatives that we assume. We have to make every conceivable effort to keep as many Jews as possible, and we have to stretch. I say this advice. Am I being taped? Listen, I always say on these lecture tours, if you don't like what I'm saying, you can call my chairman of the board. Her name is Shirley Lamb. No. We have to stretch the halacha to its utmost permissible limits to keep the Jews included in Am Yisrael. To those who triumphantly say in their hearts, but the Frum will survive, that the others are not Jews anyway, that it's no great loss if they vanish, they vanish. I say, God help us. What did success do to spoil Rock Hunter? What did it do to us? Did my grandfather, was he ever able to say that? He was a Gan Olam. He knew more than a whole lot of people today. Would he dare to even think it? I say, no, these Jews are our brothers, Achenu B'nai Yisrael. And Jews don't treat brothers that way. We may not hate them. We may not ignore them. We may not say if they vanish, they vanish. We're commanded to love every one of them. We always were. And we should. And unless they're epikursim, mishumodim, minim, I don't have to translate it for you, who will make that decision anyway? Who's going to make that decision that they are that? I say no. We cannot think that they are just casualties. This is a war. They're casualties. Too bad. Because they have built hospitals. They have built chesed societies. They built Israel. We didn't. They built Israel. They helped the poor and the deranged. They hoarded anti-Semitism. We can't cut off good people. The end product, the 40 generations of training and refining. That Jew is not simply a Jew who's here today. He had a father and a grandfather and a great-grandfather who probably were from Eden. And 5 and 6 generations ago suffered to be Jews, and from Sinai came all of these people who suffered and travailed and survived. We're going to write off their grandchild in an era when Hitler wiped out 6 million Jews? We're going to wipe out 4 million Jews? Do I exaggerate it? Well, you may think so. And you may think that that my speech is maybe too powerful for the situation. I assure you, I don't think so. I'm very rational about this and fairly cool sometimes, much of the time. This is not to be believed that it could happen. And I say to you, no, we may not let it happen. No, 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 6 million times no. I am not an alarmist, but this is alarming. And the second quality of triumphalism is the splintering of our Orthodox community. Now listen, we're talking about an Orthodox community, a frum community, Shomrei Mitzvahs, Shomrei Torah, go to shul, with mechitzis, with gut kosher flesh, largely we're frum Jews. How bad can it be? How bad can it be? Instead, we see a divisiveness that, if it goes a little further, chas v'sholem, we will implode. And we can't allow that to happen. The negative aspects of our triumph, I read you the positive ones. And I'm not calling for pluralism. And I'm not saying that Reformed Jews have an equally valid, you know, direct route to God, or that conservative Jews do that. I'm saying that the way of Torah is the way we've learned it. And we've got to learn more Torah. And maybe that's the answer to it. And we've got to daven more. And we've got to daven with more passion. Because centrist Orthodox Jews have a great deal of compassion, but a great shortage of passion in their davening. Compassion, yes, and passion, no. And there are other things that are wrong and that we have to correct. No, I'm not whitewashing anyone. I'm only saying to you that while I'm not pluralistic in that sense, because I believe that the way to God is what Torah told us, I sure shun the idea of divisiveness, of making kitos, little organizations here, a rav giving all kind of piskei halacha over there, another rav doing that, and with no system, with no sense, with no rationality. When I heard in Eretz Yisrael that there was a chumrah on walking on carpet, because the carpet had shatnez. When I heard in Eretz Yisrael that a rav said that a woman is not permitted to speak on a cell phone, because he went on a bus and a woman was speaking very loud on a cell phone or something like that. When I hear other kinds of things which are the utterances of people who are, you know, off the line, and there are gedolim amongst us, even after the passing of Reb Moshe, the Shlomo Zalman Urbach, there are gedolim, understanding, mature gedolim. I'm not talking about the chumras and such. I'm talking about separatism. I'm talking about the emergence of an anti-modern community that is very proud of its bearing and will not even associate with anyone, despite the fact that it is a shomer mitzvahs to the same extent. I want to tell you something. I don't talk about myself, but I think that I'm a shomer mitzvahs like the Munkach Rebbe. Not like the Rav Zusha, and not like the famous people who are Yirei Shemayim when I can't reach their Yira Shemayim. But I'm as frum as the Baruch Bar Chosid. And I'm as frum as the B'nai Yeshiva. The Yeshiva world, as it were. And there's no reason for a detail to separate us. We're so small. How can we do it? Just because there's this kind of feeling of triumph. I mean, there was Rav Samson, Rafael Hirsch, and Rav Cook. Rav Cook embraced the Chalutzim, who were in Eretz Yisrael. And Rav Hirsch didn't do that. He believed in Torah and Derech Eretz. He lived alongside it. But he understood the culture. He understood there were other people, people who have different kinds of thoughts, who didn't like them. He wasn't pluralistic, chas v'shalom. And Rav Cook wasn't. But they couldn't believe this divisiveness, this hatred of Am Yisrael. This considering them, if they vanish, they vanish. What is that but a result of intellectual hatred, which is not to be believed? The decision when dissension within Orthodoxy is not only style and dress, because a chassid wouldn't be caught dead wearing this tie. On the other hand, I wouldn't be caught dead wearing a shtreimel. My grandfather wore one, and I think many of our grandfathers did. And Baruch Hashem, they want to wear shtreimel. I come from a Hasidic family. Baruch Hashem, they're Hasidim. Baruch Hashem, they did daven. Baruch Hashem, they walk home with that tefillin 10 o'clock in the morning. Baruch Hashem, they're that way. There's some excellent, beautiful things, magnificent things they're doing. But the device is not to be tolerated. The Torah Umada argument, the right wing, the left wing, and the centrist is beyond me. In the Hasidic world, it's Ger versus Belz. Then it was Rav Shach versus the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Zichron Tzedek Levracha, and the Lubavitch versus Gera, and all kinds of conflicts. And if we just eliminate the Meshuggah factor, we will understand
that if a sociologist looked at it, he would say, what are you guys arguing for? He will say what my mother said when my brother and I left all the toys on the room. She said, I don't care who did it, clean it up. When are we going to clean it up? It's okay if they want to disagree. And I don't know the situation in Toronto. Let us say, I do know it, but I can't speak about it, and I don't know it enough. And I don't know what's valid and what's not valid. I can only tell you about New York. Better yet, I can tell you about California, which when I was there, when I first came there, was a shtetl, and is now rife with Jews and with fights. I want to tell you only the how to cope with this challenge, what I think. There's a Meshech Chochma, a beautiful commentary on Torah, which is stunning, that the man said this in language that I wouldn't say, and I can only quote, is remarkable. And I use it for this situation today. The Meshech Chochma, who was, in fact, the Or Sameach, and the Or Sameach, Remeya Simcha of Divinsk, was the Litvashidov in the town, and the Chassidishidov in town was the Rogachova, one of the most brilliant, incredibly brilliant, difficult to understand, makes Immanuel Kant sound like Little Red Riding Hood. The Rogachova and the Meir Simcha, two titans of Jewish thinking, of learning, who are close friends. They didn't only tolerate each other. They spoke to each other. They're friendly. The Meshech Chochma says there are two kinds of mitzvahs. You know all about the regular division of mitzvahs, negative, positive. He said no. There are two kinds of mitzvahs. One are mitzvahs ma'asios, religious mitzvahs. Don't worship idols. Don't steal. There's a religious command. Relate to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. No avodah zarah. And then there are mitzvos nimusios, ethical mitzvos, moral obligations. Not individual mitzvos, but midos. Midos means values. It's a beautiful word, values. And values such as chesed, kindness, not talking lashon hara, gossip, or evil about other people, not causing machlokos, dissension, arguments, more. Than arguing for the sake of argument. It's an interesting distinction. Look what happens to it. It's almost unthinkable. On a personal level, a person who violates avodah zarah, God punishes him. Excised from the people or death gets punished. A person who speaks lashon hara, gossip, we don't punish him. God punishes him in the way that God knows. But the court can't put that man to death for lashon hara. First of all, it's probably alav she'en bo maaseh. There's no action connected with it. He didn't do any physical action. In any case, an individual is punishable for worshiping idols. He's not punishable for starting machlokas, starting arguments. Now on a public level, look what happens. It's totally reversed. If a whole public worships avodah zarah, God can live with it. But if a whole public speaks lashon hara and creates machlokas and dissension and fighting amongst each other, God can't tolerate it. He wipes them out. That's incredible. Why? Why should this be? Because a public religious transgression like avodah zarah, idolatry, surely evil, ugly, disgusting, still doesn't warrant destruction. But a sin so vile, so much worse than committing religious sin, is a sin of midos, of values. Because when you commit a sin, you committed a one-time act, which you may replicate every single day. But if you violate a midah, a value, it means what you have done is to corrupt your interior. Your whole personality is evil.